so it's like, I don't know if he remembered or not.
Well, I'm afraid things like a previous interview / lunch and then traffic gridlock got in the way. I'm just back in the newspaper building now.
Okay.
So sorry, I was running late there.
That's fine, just one moment.
All right. Mr. Hewitt, yes. Hi, Bob Ward in Huntsville.
Yeah, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, I'm doing great. A little bit, a few minutes behind the curve here on my schedule. I hope
don't worry about it. It's
good.
Fine.
Thanks. I really appreciated your response, and I'm still finishing up the last touches of my research on this new Von Braun anecdotage, if you will.
Yes,
And certainly recommended that I speak with you if at all possible.
Yeah.
So I know you and Dr. Von Braun were quite close there for, what, a considerable period of time.
Well, it was, you know, it was really late in his life, but because I spent pretty much a lot of time with him in a very short period of time, really, if you look at it. I became executive director of the National Space Institute. I was the first employee. And Warner was, you know, the initiating founding chairman of the National Space Institute, and that was in 1974.
I see. Okay.
And, of course, Warner passed away in 1977, so
correct.
All intents and purposes, I only spent 3 years with Warner.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I spent a great deal of time. We traveled quite a little bit together, and, you know, we, you know, tried to put the Institute together and tried to go along the lines that, get that going. So, yeah, it was short but intense, you might say.
And Hugh Downs, I guess, was involved.
He was president. Have you had a chance to talk to Hugh?
I have indeed. He was very responsive and had a number of favorite stories.
Yeah, Hugh was a great guy, and he was very dedicated to the space program, and you know, was a major factor in our ability to keep it going, especially after the untimely death of Warner.
Mm-hmm.
I think just continue to play, although I've gone off another direction. I'm still involved in satellites and those kind of things, but I'm no longer you know, directly involved with that program.
So. Exactly. And you head up the SBCA.
Yes, I'm the president of the SBCA.
Right. That's what I thought.
Have you had a chance to talk to Tom Turner?
You know, I wrote him. He and you were the only two of about a handful of 8 or 10 people at one time that I did write. I guess it was back in November, and I've not heard from him. I've not followed up.
Yeah, see, Tom spent all the time with Warner before I met Warner, because Tom was at Fairchild and had some stories. I'll relate one story to you because it was not unusual in a way, but it illustrates both sort of the way Warner was, but also his brilliance and his magnetism that he had. You know, for one thing, you know, if you walk through an airport with Warner, he had such a presence that even people who didn't really know who he was for sure knew he was somebody. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
He just had a magic to him. Of course, he was a very handsome man, and he was really something. But Tom told the story about they were flying over to Oxford because Warner was going to give a lecture over at Oxford. You know.
Not as in Mississippi, right?
No, not as in Mississippi.
Right.
And so Oxford University, of course.
Of course.
And Tom had helped him put together a presentation while Warner had put together a little too much. He'd had two carousel slides and a 20-minute film.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tom was very concerned and really tried his best to get him to cut some of it down. He did cut some of it. He did pare it down, but he said he went over and he started to give the lecture. He hadn't been 5 minutes of lecture and the power went out. And he lost all the power. So Warner went ahead and gave it without his slides and without his films, and he spoke for about a little over 2 hours.
Is that right?
As he was ending, the power came back on. Trump said not a person got out, went out of that hallway. They were mesmerized, you know, by Warner's presentation and sat through the whole 4.5 hours.
I'll be damned. You know, someone else, I think it was Ed Ewell, you know, the former
Churchill
CEO.
Well.
I've talked with Ed at great length, and he had some wonderful stories as well, and a real warm place in his heart for Dr. Von Braun. Something similar happened in Iran when the Shah was in power, and the royal projectionist couldn't get the projection machine going, and Werner had to do the same thing, and then he had to vamp for about an hour until they finally, and the royal projectionist would accept no help, you know.
Well, of course not.
And so Werner just kind of tap danced, and finally, you know, an hour, that was only an hour later they got it working, and he proceeded to continue and something along the same lines, you know, not a soul left.
Oh, yeah.
But this is good. I'll certainly use this.
Yeah, and something similar but a little different. We, Werner and I had traveled down to Dallas. We were holding a major fundraiser down there to support the Institute, and it was a gigantic dinner. Bob Hope was going to be the keynote speaker. John Denver sang.
This was in Dallas.
Unfortunately, Werner ultimately was not able to attend because he had become ill.
Mm-hmm.
But Werner, we went down to have sort of reception of some of the leadership of Dallas to try to interest them into helping sponsor this big dinner. And you know, I Werner and I sat down and said, "Well, Werner, these are the major points." You know, I said, "I'll talk a little bit," but then he really came to hear you talk, and I said, "You really want to keep focusing back in on this event and the need for funding of the space program and all the things we're doing and research and this kind of stuff." He says, "Yeah." He says, "I got it. These are the three things I need to do." Well, we go in, and I say my little piece, and I introduce Werner, and he says some very general comments, and a lady holds her upper hand and asks him a question about nuclear fission, which, of course, was no place on our agenda.
Right.
And, of course, he proceeds to talk for 45 minutes on nuclear fission. And everyone thought you could have heard, this is a cocktail party. A person went for a drink. He just had them all just in vase. But of course, we weren't there to talk about nuclear.
this was in a stand-up.
Reception. And I tell you, you could have heard a bit. Now we're talking about people who are, you know, half the people in the room were just basically socialites.
Sure.
They were the kind of people who normally would never do interest. But when he spoke of it, it was just so fascinating.
Did he talk about an hour, you said?
He spoke 45 minutes, as I recall, it was at least 45 minutes.
I'll be dead.
And afterwards, we said a few other things. It went over very well, of course, ultimately. But we were walking there, and says, "I got, did I get a little carried away?" I said, "Yeah, but it worked okay."
Oh, that is priceless. That's great.
Yeah.
He was
really fantastic. Of course, we had a lot of great personal visits and stuff. And I'm sure you've heard all the stories about how he came over in a trolley car from Mexico.
Through El Paso,
Juarez,
yes.
You know, some of his good you know, colleagues from Huntsville know those stories much better than I do. I've heard them, you know, several times. I got to think of other things, because it was never dull. I'd have to give a little more thought to if I could come up. So there are more.
Well, good. Let me ask you this. Of course, it is on the downside, though. But with his illness, and of course, I've talked with Ed and others, Ernst Stuhlinger and Fred Ordway and others who were close to him when his months were dwindling down. Do you recall any comment by him about his illness?
Absolutely. In fact, as soon as you brought that up, that's the first thing that flipped in my head. The came in, and he said, well, Chuck, he said, you know, they can't say I'm not American now. I've had, 467 pints of American blood flowing through me.
Yes,
that right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. So, you know, there, as sick as he was, he still was able to maintain a sense of humor that most of us would have had a difficult time with. So, he's quite a guy.
He sure was, and you knew him a lot better than I did. I knew him only, I was a young reporter then, so there was a little arm's length there, but I so admired him. Let's see. I know, and I've learned even more lately here, researching what an avid hunter he was.
Yes.
And a sportsman of all kinds, and a passionate pilot. I knew that he flew, in fact, going from a space conference in St. Louis in the mid-60s. Back to Huntsville, he flew a DC-3, and one of the PR guys said, "Bob, you want to ride? I know you got your airline ticket. You want to ride on this Goonie Bird with Dr. Von Braun at the controls?" I said, "Yes, if he can." Has he checked out?
Yeah, has he checked out? That's a big question.
That's right. He said, "Oh yes, and he just loves to fly anything, anywhere, whenever he can get his hands on it." And so I did so, and went up in the cockpit and visited with him some there. He just was just shining. He loved piloting. So anything that comes to mind about those hobbies and avocations, those kind of fun pursuits of his?
Well, you know, he was fascinated by everything. So he is an example of a man who constantly sought knowledge, and whether it was from his outdoor experiences or from science or technology. I recall we went over to a satellite conference here in D.C. and he was going to I think that was the time he was going to receive an award, and we were walking down through the exhibit area, and here's a man with vast knowledge of more things than I could even I couldn't even remember all the areas in which he was expert. We all of a sudden we stop at the replica of the Mars landing, the Viking, and he started looking at this mechanical arm on the scoop that goes out to collect up the dirt and stuff.
Right.
And we were late because he just couldn't pull himself away before we clearly understood how the mechanical arm worked.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was just fascinating to see how he could get so caught up in trying to garner the information and the knowledge necessary so he could understand this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what drove him through all of his life. It drove him through, his great dream of going to the moon and rockets, but it also drove him in his personal life, his drive to say, he loved Alaska. In fact, that's unfortunately where he learned of Zillness.
Yes, that's what
he was in Alaska, and he was. It was really unfortunate because he came back that was in, I believe, the winter of 76 is when he found out.
Mm-hmm.
And he only lived about 6 months after he had discovered his illness.
Right.
A little bit more longer than that. I can't recall too sure.
It may have been 75, maybe the latter part.
Maybe it was. Maybe it was, because I'm trying to remember. Yeah. I know it was winter.
Mm-hmm.
Or not winter, but it was late fall or something like that. I can't. It wasn't too many years. I'm
sure. Yes, we are going back a ways here.
Yeah.
And you cut me off when you need to. Anything that comes to mind regarding his family? He was as busy as he was, a pretty good family man.
Yes, he was.
I'm gathering husband, father, and
yes,
three children.
good him.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be awful intimidating to have Warner as your father.
I would think so. And that apparently has been felt with some of the cats, which I'm not going to go into all of that.
No, I think it was very difficult. I only met his younger son.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't meet any of the kids. But,
right.
I think they had a very difficult time.
Peter either lives with or near his mother in the Alexandria area there. And I understand he kind of went through, you know, rejection or denial or whatever, and wanted to, didn't even want to go by the name Von Braun.
Yes.
And wanted to, he just called himself Braun, I think, and has basically been working in recent years in rather clerical or menial jobs. And,
I think it was just overwhelming for him.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
I just think that, you know, when I had met him, he was not very responsive to, you know, to just, he really wouldn't talk very much, almost recluse.
Right.
I think he did only average in school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't believe that Warner put any real pressure on him.
Right.
But that might have been a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So I just can't say. I mean, I certainly am not a person to try to pass any judgments or anything. But,
sure.
I think it was not easy, and I'm sure no, it wasn't easy for Maria.
Right. You know? Right. I hear that Margaret though is a college teacher and has her master's, and I'm not sure about PhD in physics, and I think it's physics. It's one of the natural or physical sciences, and is doing quite well teaching, I want to say, in the north, in the Midwest, in one of the Dakotas, or maybe it's Iowa or someplace there. Sort of out of the beaten path, but apparently quite devoted to her technically oriented career. And the other children have achieved less. I think the other daughter, and then Peter, the son.
Yes. I guess say I didn't really know them well, and I think that there was a restraint. Warner pretty much. I think he felt guilt over this, and he felt kind of guilty about his
children.
And I think part of the problem was I think he pretty much let Maria call all the shots,
mm-hmm.
and make all the decisions, and I think she had to in the earlier years. And then when it came kind of time when he could, I think it was too late.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I say, I'm. Not that there's any blame anywhere for any, you know, serious problems, and, you know, I don't think there is any super serious problems.
Right.
Certainly, the kids, I think, had a pretty rough time.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Did you say that nothing really that comes to mind regarding his love of hunting?
No, I am not a hunter myself.
Right, I'm not either.
And so, therefore, I'd be very handicapped because I, you know, I never took any trips with him,
mm-hmm.
For hunting. Like I said, I did travel quite a little bit with him, but I never really spent a lot of time doing that kind of thing.
Right, right. Was most of your travel together domestically here in the U.S.?
I did not do any international travel with him.
Do you know a fellow named, I think he's a doctor, Carsby Adams?
No, I do not know.
C.C. Adams, he was a Georgia plantation owner, I think of several thousand acres, who became friends with Warner in the, if not the late 50s, then in the 60s, and they did some hunting together.
Well, just someone you could admire. I mean, there are the questions of the years he was, you know, he was in Germany in those years. And he talked to me at a great length about that. Not at my request, interesting enough, but sort of volunteered a lot of questions.
Sure. Did he share any recollections or impressions of some of the key Third Reich figures?
Yeah, he told me a story of the time when he was in Peenemünde and he suddenly got noticed to report back to the main headquarters there, and he went back and Himmler was there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Himmler said, we're going to fly to Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got on the plane. And of course, back in those days, he said you didn't know if you were flying to Berlin to be killed or
mm-hmm.
to be given a medal, you know.
Right.
You just didn't know what the deal was. And
mm-hmm.
as it worked out, and yes, he said he had to be awful careful because everyone had their enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And so as he went back, he walked in and they took him to the headquarters and where Hitler and Himmler and who else was there? I'm trying to recall if I remember who else was there. In any sense, they made him
Goring or some
Goring. It probably was Goring.
Yeah.
They and Hitler made him a member of the Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm. So that's how that happened.
And Werner said that he had to make a very difficult choice. He said he felt his choice was to live or not to live.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided to live.
Mm.
And of course, a lot of people, especially in England, have held that against him. I mean, that just sort of confirmed that he was, you know, I mean, a lot of people believe that he was a Nazi.
Right.
I know he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, regardless of that story is 100% accurate or not, Werner had too much compassion for his fellow human being and for mankind to have ever been believe in the Nazi doctrine. But it's something that
I believe that too.
Yeah, it's something that it was very difficult for him to live with. Obviously, he had he received threats from time to time, and I think it was difficult for him. Obviously, you just have to live with.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to make a long story short, he said that. I guess I'll give you my opinion. My opinion is that thank God he accepted it, or we'd still be going to the moon.
I have to totally agree with you. I don't have a doubt in my mind. He was that perfect and unique, I guess, combination of the managerial and leadership abilities and inspiration and technical knowledge and all
everything requires to be able to do that kind of thing.
Right. And that was, I was taking notes here as well as, I am taping this and I hope that's all right, so I'll get it accurately. Did you say Berlin is where they were flying?
Yes, they flew to Berlin.
I thought you said that. That is, I've never heard exactly that story.
Well,
I know that a commission in the SS was also pressed on him, forced on him, really, and he conferred with some of his colleagues at Peenemünde, and they said you better take it.
Yeah, that was the way it was, you know. And I think it's probably awful easy for people to condemn those decisions, but it's also we were put in those kind of positions, it's not too clear to me that we wouldn't have made the very same decision.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm pretty certain I would have. I mean,
exactly.
You know, so
some of these revisionists, and we just had one visit us, just don't factor in the Amen. Okay, well, I'll let you go for the moment unless something else has occurred to you now.
Things keep popping back.
Well, I know. We could probably talk another hour.
Yeah.
Let me see if there's anything that pops in my mind.
By the way, I think you may be the first person I've ever told this story to.
Oh, is that right?
Well, I'm not sure. I can't recall of ever telling anyone else because I always felt he told it to me privately.
Mm-hmm.
It was on a flight to Seattle when he told me.
Mm.
And I never asked the question. I never raised the issue ever. And he just suddenly started telling me the story.
Yeah, that's...
I think it gnawed on
that's
him.
That's fascinating.
I think it bothered him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was about to say, well, there's a Dr. Michael Neufeld or Norfeld, Canadian, who is the curator of military history at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. And he wrote a book about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, The Rocket and the Reich, in which he holds von Braun in complicity for 20,000 deaths. I think those are mostly of concentration camp forced laborers, and some of the 10,000 or so that died in England and Belgium, I think, with the V2.
Well, the English have held him responsible for those rockets.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but even British military intelligence, I understand, who knows, maybe with some pressure from the U.S. folks, absolved him of war atrocities, anyway, I mean, other than building weapons for war, and they did, of course, kill a lot of civilians, but I guess that's happened before and since. Nobody's been tried, but Norfell came down in the heart of St. Werner country here and proceeded to, I think he held some of his punches, he pulled some of his punches, but he didn't back down from holding him. Maybe responsible for sins of omission as much as anything else.
Well,
and he didn't stand up and say, I refuse to work in any way that's connected with slave laborers.
Yeah, well, that's awful brave of him to say. I wonder if he would have done that.
Exactly, and half the audience confronted him with that argument.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's awful brave to be sitting here after the fact and talk about how, wrong someone acted. But I have real reservations that he or the great majority of any of us would have done anything differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to also take into account that, I still maintain we were awful lucky that's what he did.
Mankind is awfully lucky, you're right.
Absolutely, and again, when you look at the, I think, of the record, I think you find that it just would be awful hard for me for ever to believe that he was in any way or form a Nazi or someone who was involved in this because he just had too much compassion.
Right, not a committed, believing, willing Nazi. Right.
It would just be beyond me that he could be.
All the empirical evidence around suggests that that's not the case. That he was not a believing. You know, he was not a believer at all. What about matters of religion and spirituality? Did he ever?
We seldom discussed religion.
Mm-hmm.
He was a religious man.
Right.
We just never, we just never discussed it.
I interviewed his Huntsville Episcopal pastor, or the closest thing that really was a pastor to him. It was where the family went, and Dr. Von Braun went a little less than they, and he was out of town so much,
and they were hunting buddies.
Oh, I see.
And they went on, and he's got some great stories that he just shared with me last month on some hunting trips in Arkansas, and they were all deer hunting trips in South Alabama. And it's like the making of Warner the good old boy.
Yeah.
Of course, he loved, he grew up in a hunting atmosphere in Germany on the baronial estate. And continued that, but he really got into hunting in the South big time, and actually, you know, loved it apparently. But I do have some great stories on hunting trips. Okay, anything else?
I think that's probably it for now.